my name is Emily Franson, your host and producer for Welcome to My Nerd Brain. I am thrilled to be here today with Sharon Su, who is a classical pianist, scholar, and chamber musician. Sharon, I would like to welcome you to My Nerd Brain.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Yes, thank you for being here. You're actually one of a couple of people that I found on Twitter. I never thought that I would use Twitter for like its actual intended purpose, but here I am. And I was just so pleasantly surprised to come across a, you know, sarcastic and witty classical pianist, because that's just not a thing that like exists in nature. And I know, you know, being a classical musician myself, I kind of have a little bit of disdain for the uppity reputation that us classical musicians tend to have. And I've, you know, the more time I've spent in kind of the classical music world, I feel like there's a lot of gatekeeping going on. How do you keep your sense of humor when you are, you know, in academic settings where you have to be professional and you're listening to these people talk about just the most nuanced things you've ever heard in your life?
It's so funny because when you sent me your notes for this episode and we're like, we're going to talk about humor in classical music, I was like, oh my gosh. Like, I felt some sense of dread because I have so much to say about humor in classical music and how it aligns with gatekeeping. I was like, how many hours do you have for me? Because I have so much to say about it. I really feel like for whatever reason, you know, people know me for being funny, which to me itself is really funny because I don't feel like I'm here, you know, shoehorning humor into things or like trying to like force humor into classical music. Like, it's not me trying to like pander or trying to, you know, like dumb it down or make it relatable. Mm-hmm. I'm just teasing out and showing people the humor that's already there.
Yeah.
Like, classical music itself has so much humor. And you know, we're talking about like these scholars and academics who often, you know, will be very serious. Like, they have a lot of humor too. When, you know, you go to conservatory, you go through classical music training, you attend summer festivals, there's just all of this incredible, super, super specific niche humor. And like, everyone is laughing all the time at these extremely specific jokes and like making jokes and references that like absolutely no like normal person would get.
Right.
And that's one of the like really pure things I really love about music in this field. And I just try to like remind people that they have that in them, you know, and that there is a place for that, both in these more serious settings and also when you are, you know, bringing the art form to the larger masses. I feel like so much of the time we feel like when we present music to people, when we talk about it, we have to extract all the humor and like, you know, stow it away. And I feel like that's not, I don't know, the best approach, because humor is, it's just part of it. It's part of any form of human expression. It's a very human thing. And there is no field that's entirely devoid of humor, you know? I kind of feel like for me, I try to maintain that perspective that helps me to, you know, keep everything in mind, not just the seriousness, not just the nerdiness, but also the humor. I feel like the fact that I'm particularly interested in history has something to do with it. Like, I don't know what it is exactly, but I feel like the more you learn about the history of anything, not just music, like anything, the funnier it seems, because you just have this longer view of things. Mm-hmm. You're able to put things more in context, and it just sometimes makes the things that we do seem more absurd. Like, I don't know if anyone else does this, but I have these dissociative moments where I will be doing something, or I'll be, you know, in a concert or something. I'll just look around and look at what I'm doing or look at what other people are doing, and it'll just make no sense to me. like a lot of people make a big deal about the fact that in the official bio on my website, I identify as a finger wiggler and not as a pianist. And, you know, they kind of think it's like this cute twee thing that I'm doing, but like, it's genuinely from these moments I've had where, you know, I'm playing and then I'll realize, you know, I'm literally just sitting at a big piece of furniture wiggling my fingers and people think that's art. Like, that's so absurd.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you look around in concert and everyone is just like silent and their ears are processing these sound waves and it's making them feel feelings. I'm just like, that is so strange. So when you have these moments in the times you realize that so much of what we do is just entirely and utterly absurd and arbitrary. And it just, I don't know, makes you realize that a lot of what we do is kind of funny.
Yeah. I'm actually very interested that she brought up the music history end of things, because that's what I was teaching when I was still teaching at universities. It was actually mostly music history classes, even though my master's is in piano performance. So I was constantly like reading tons of literature to play catch up and, you know, make sure I kind of knew what I was talking about. And when you come across, I think particularly letters from composers, that stuff is hilarious.
Like, oh my gosh, it's so funny. There's also so much dunking that went on too.
I know.
Like, you read, like, I was reading some of the stuff that, like, Fanny Mendelssohn wrote and, like, Arshima wrote, and, like, they were really savage. Like, the things that they said about other composers, I was just like, oh my gosh, like, that, like, these are, like, you know, these could be modern day Twitter beefs. It's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, one of my personal favorites is Beethoven's letters, and I'm reading his right now. And so much of it is just him being an asshole. Like, he's just he just writes these letters that are like, oh, well, I see that you haven't paid me my whatever ducat. So it's like, oh my god, this guy is such a jerk.
Yeah, it's amazing, because I mean, I feel like we think so often of these composers as being like these noble figures. They're like godlike almost, and I think we forget that, you know, humor is part of the DNA of their music. Like I said, any form of human expression is going to have humor. Anyone who expresses things is going to be funny at points. Like, I was thinking about the fact that last week I went to a performance that the LA Phil did at the Hollywood Bowl, and they did Peter and the Wolf by Prokofiev. And people were laughing out loud, not at the narration, but at the musical cues. Like, people were finding the music funny. And I'm like, that's just so, that's like so Prokofiev. Because I think of Prokofiev as being, you know, wry and sarcastic and witty. So even in, you know, things for kids like Peter and Wolf, you hear that. Or like, you know, you think of Bach, he did really funny things in his music. Same with like Haydn and Beethoven and Mozart. Like, when I was studying a lot of Beethoven, I was really diving into, you know, his stuff, like you're saying, the letters, but also his music. And like, he does some like really, really funny things in his music that are like, they're definitely there as jokes. And when I was studying and learning the scherzo movements of the Clara Schumann Sonata that I recorded, there are these super clear instructions for a joke at the end of the movements. So like at the end, it's repeating this motif that, you know, has gone through the entire movement. And she has very specific instructions for you to just play it slower and slower and slower and more quietly. And so it sounds like it's fading out, and then just come right in with the 5-1 cadence, like really loud in tempo. And it's just, there is no other way to interpret that as a joke, because it is really, really funny when you follow those exact instructions. So like the music, like I said, is part of the humor is part of the DNA of the music. Yeah. And we can't forget that.
Yeah. Well, what you said too about, I mean, being a pianist is a weird profession. Like, how, you know, how is this a thing? I mean, I've been teaching for a long time, and some of my students are very serious. Some of them are not so serious, but, you know, everybody has a breakdown in a lesson at some point, some more than others. And I always just find myself telling them, you know, nobody died from playing the piano. This is not, you don't have to be that upset about this.
Like, yeah, it's so true.
Just like, we keep it in perspective.
We take things so seriously, but yeah, I mean, we should take it seriously. I'm not saying that we should, you know, not like focus ourselves, but it's not life or death.
No. And, you know, classical music does have that reputation for being, quote, serious music. And I don't know that that's done us a lot of good over the years.
Right. I think if anything, it puts your audience on edge, especially if they are people who are not familiar with classical music. They think that they have to be, you know, really serious and really stuffy and like really cerebral.
Right.
And like, yes, there is cerebral music, but like I said, there is also so much humor. And if you close people off to that, you lose an opportunity, I think, to really show how this art form does encompass so many parts of humanity.
Yeah. So that leads me to my next question. Do you feel like classical music is exclusionary?
Oh, yeah. I feel like it's a very loaded question, but like, absolutely. And obviously, there's a lot to unpack there. I'm not just going to say, yes, exclusionary, and then right. leave. I feel like, you know, I think about this a lot, obviously, because it's something that affects me. And it's also something that I try not to perpetuate. Although I'm sure that I know that I have in so many ways, because you don't really think about it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, at every level in music, you know, both professional amateurs and on the audience side and the performance side and in the industry itself, at every level, there are so many conscious and unconscious biases, just like there are in any other industry. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, I feel like there's no shortage of stories or data, like in any industry, that like, it's so clear that, you know, very human thing that we do is we sometimes perpetuate exclusionary ideas. And so the complicating factor, I think, that is somewhat unique to classical music is that there's this particularly insidious concept that the music that we play is universal. Mm-hmm. I'm using very heavy air quotes there.
Yeah.
And that the system automatically rewards and elevates musicians purely based on merit.
Right.
Like, this is definitely an idea that I think we perpetuate, and that, you know, isn't a terrible idea. It would be amazing if, you know, the system only, you know, elevated people based on merit. But as a result of this kind of, you know, myth, I feel like there's more resistance to the idea that there are inequities that we have to change. You look at, you know, the very necessary reckonings that we've had with movements like Me Too and Black Lives Matter. It's, you know, those things have upended so much stuff in so many industries. And I feel like, for me, just I found anecdotally that there are so many classical music fans who are open to the idea of change in other areas, but are resistant and push back on the idea that there's any kind of rot or need for reform in classical music. You know, because like their thinking is, how can anything as transcendent and noble as classical music have flaws? Like, it's supposed to be, you know, this higher sphere of, you know, of idealism. So I kind of feel like a lot of people who would otherwise be, you know, somewhat open-minded are very closed off to the idea that there is exclusion in classical music because of these myths that are perpetuated.
Yeah. So do you have any thoughts on what we could do about that? That's kind of an unfair question.
Of course I have thoughts. It's something that, you know, obviously I can't come up with some like magical rubric for change. Right. I can't be like, oh, follow these instructions and we'll fix things. It's the type of thing that kind of requires so many people to buy in and do the work on so many levels, you know, both as consumers and creators of music. And I kind of feel like a lot of it does come down to accepting that we do have unconscious bias and that we do, you know, perpetuate so many of the myths that hold us back. And I think a really, 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 really big thing that people have to do is to listen, and particularly to listen to the people who are the most oppressed, you know, under mm-hmm. these systems. So, you know, I kind of feel like listen to, you know, women when they're talking about sexism in music. Don't just, you know, like play it off and be like, oh, you are, you know, overreacting or being too sensitive to things. These aren't real issues because I haven't experienced them. Like,
right.
If, you know, if a woman is telling you about something that is happening to women, like you got to listen, you got to, you know, kind of listen in good faith and trust that they may experience something that you don't. Same with people of color. If they're telling you about racism and white supremacy, don't just be like, you know, well, I think you're making that up, or I don't think that's real, I think that's a hoax, whatever. Like, you have to listen, because there is this long journey to trusting people with your story and trying to tell them about these problems. If someone brings them up, they're not small issues. They are things you have to listen to. Same for, you know, there's been so many stories about abuse in in music, you know, with teachers abusing their students. There have been so many stories about, you know, fat phobia and transphobia in music. And I feel like so many times people who don't themselves see or experience these things, they just play them off. Or they go, you know, well, sure, but we have these larger things we need to focus on. And so I feel like the first big step that people have to do is to listen to the people who are coming to you with these problems. That's like the very, you know, bare minimum that we have to do in order to move forward at all, mm-hmm. before we even get into, you know, the concrete actions that we can take.
Right. You know, I saw a thread on Twitter recently that kind of, I'm not even sure how to describe how it made me feel, but the
that's
thread,
Twitter for you.
Yeah, right, exactly. The thread started as, you know, music teachers make sure that you always ask permission before you touch your students. And I was like, yeah, okay, that's a great idea. I do that all the time. And it kind of devolved into this thing where somebody, I mean, literally said a teacher should never have to touch their students in a lesson. I was like, whoa, wait a minute. I'm sorry, but like, how are you teaching that you can accomplish that? And
it
kind of, you know, it set me off a little bit because I was like, you know this comes from a good place and I understand the place it's coming from. And yes, you do need to ask a child's permission before you grab their hand. But like, I don't know that you can go through 20 years of piano lessons without somebody like adjusting your shoulder at some point. You know? And I don't know. I feel like in some sense, people are using, you know, platforms like you're talking about, like the Me Too movement and like the Black Lives Matter movement, to kind of elevate the wrong things. You know, it's like, wait, I mean, somebody pushing your shoulder down is very different from the territory that you're going into. And we also can't perpetuate this idea that any music teacher who touches a student to adjust something is a molester. Like, come on.
Yeah.
You know, that does just as much damage as if you had not said anything at all.
Right. I think the problem with like, so, you know, Twitter especially, but like social media in general, is that there are, it encourages these very binary ways of thinking where it's like, you know, either this,
right,
it's very either or. And I would point out that, you know, teachers who are abusive will find ways to abuse their students even if they never touch them. Like the issue is not the action, it's the intention, it's the philosophy. It's interesting because I feel like for most of my training, you know, teachers would, you know, touch my arm or my hand or whatever and, you know, point things out. And it was enormously helpful because as a kid, you know, you're not so aware of the discrete parts of your body that, you know, if a teacher were to say to 8-year-old me, like, you know, like lower your shoulders and like elevate this part of your wrist, I'd be like, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Exactly. Yeah.
That being said, I went to a music festival a couple of years ago. And it was just, it was very natural. I was having all these lessons with teachers, you know, I'd never studied with. And before they touched my arm or wrist or whatever, they would say, oh, do you mind if I touch your wrist? Which I found really considerate because I had not been aware of that, you know, conversation that people were having about, you know, whether you should or shouldn't touch your students. And so for me, it was really new. I was like, oh my gosh, like I've never been asked permission before. And it just like, it felt very natural, but very considerate. And I appreciated that. I have the opportunity to say no. So
yeah. I definitely agree with that. And for the record, I do ask my students before I touch them. And especially since COVID, I'm like hyper aware of not touching anybody at all. I don't even like to touch the same keys they're using. But yeah, I think you're right. I think it's that very black and white area in Twitter was like, why do we have to have a fight about this? Like, the very first tweet could have been the whole conversation. It's like, I don't know. I think it just, from a perspective of being a teacher, it scares me because I'm constantly worried. Am I doing something wrong? Am I doing something wrong that I don't even know is wrong?
I think it's the type of thing where, you have to think about the space that you're making. Like, I totally completely, absolutely understand that, you know, if you've had personal experience with physical contact that, you know, has traumatized you or maybe more sensitive to these things, like, absolutely, I think it is great that, you know, as a student, you will have the opportunity to be like, I'd rather you not, you know? Right. And I think it's all about the intention. Like, you could have a teacher who says like, oh, may I touch your wrist, and do it in a way that clearly indicates that they are only saying this for the sake of saying it and are going to do it no matter what. Like, I feel like, again, it's all about the intention. It's about the space you create. And it's about whether or not overall you're building trust. Right. And trust is such a huge thing, you know, in classical music, because teaching is one-to-one, right? And it's about building relationships. And we have seen so many examples of teachers abusing that trust, and using it for ill. And so I feel like as teachers, when we are in the role of teacher in music, we have to think about the overall space we're creating and whether or not we are building actual trust with our students and not just using our power over them. Mm-hmm. So I feel like that is something that I think people just should be aware of all the time, no matter what, even if they're not in a professional, you know, sphere. Like, you always got to think about whether you are, you know, creating a safe space for the other person that you are talking to or teaching or working with or whatever.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. And I think, I guess that itself could have been the conversation, you know, mm-hmm. It was like, are you overall creating a space where your students feel like, you know, they're comfortable with you, or are you not? That's it. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But anyway, I wanted to talk to you specifically about, you know, how you prepare for performances, what kind of practice routine you have, and how you keep from injuring yourself. Because, you know, one of the things we're known for as classical musicians, and I haven't interviewed that many on this show, is, you know, sitting in practice rooms for 6 hours.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So how do you make that whole thing work?
It's just a really interesting time that you're asking me that question, because thanks to the pandemic, I haven't had performances, and my practice routine is not, you know, the same as it was pre-COVID right now. So a lot of what I'm talking about, I guess, is like very hypothetical.
Yeah.
But the thing that I feel like I had to learn, and it was like a hard lesson to learn, is that music performance is a lot like athletics, which mm-hmm. is not something that, like, it seems like one of those things that is a little obvious, but to me, I feel like there's this very popular, like, bias among classical musicians against athletics.
Yeah.
So the idea that I have to treat myself like an athlete, that was just something, a concept that, like, I was very resistant to for a long time. Mm-hmm. But as I've gotten, you know, older and wiser, I have found that that is actually true. Like, it is very much a physical thing that you're doing. It is something where you have to be very in tune with and very aware of your body, and you have to treat yourself, you know, the same way an athlete would treat their body. So I found that, like, for example, when I have performances, affects the type of work that I do, because there is such a thing as, you know, peak performance. You can't keep yourself in peak performance mode indefinitely for a sustained period of time. You have to plan it out.
Right.
So for me, you know, I will, of course, ramp up my practicing more and more in advance of performances, and then kind of back off right before the performance itself. Because if you work yourself too much and wear yourself out, you will find yourself performing in less than peak shape. So it's like this interesting thing where you definitely have to plan out getting your body, your, you know, hands and arms and everything physically in peak condition, mm-hmm. Right before, and then taking it really, really easy, like week of, stuff like that. So I feel like that's one thing that's been a little bit difficult because of the pandemic, because I don't have performances, there isn't that ramping up that I do. So right now, all my practicing is maintenance practicing. So a lot of the, like, usual technical stuff, just to keep, you know, my chops up. I'll try to, you know, do different types of practicing for different elements of musicality. But it's, again, it's not like super specific. I'm not like working myself to the bone.
Yeah.
I'm just like, I'm in maintenance mode. And like, by the way, I hate it. Like, it's so hard for me to motivate myself if I don't have a performance.
Oh, me too.
So like, I hate maintenance mode. Like, please, I want to work myself back up to peak performance again. So I have found myself lately taking more cues from, you know, from athletes. Mm-hmm. Like, you have the Olympics going on. I think about how Olympic athletes have to train and how you have to be really, really in tune with your body. And one thing that I've had to work through is the idea that you should work through the pain. Like, I kind of feel like there is this idea that you're supposed to be so devoted to your art that you don't let, you know, pain or suffering keep you back. You're supposed to just like work through it. And so for a long time, whenever I had any kind of soreness or hand pain or just fatigue, I would tell myself like, you know, it can't be weak. We got to work through this. Like, just practice harder. Mm-hmm. And that is the path to both burnout and to injury. And so I've had to, in recent years, just trust my body and trust that it knows what it's doing. So that when I feel soreness or I feel pain, it's not weakness. It's my body going like, help, you know, you need to do something about this. So it does feel a little bit like an act of almost faith, because I have to trust my body knows itself. And so when I, nowadays, if I feel any kind of soreness or pain, I stop. And it is so hard to do that because you, again, you have it so ingrained in yourself that you have to work through and push through any kind of suffering. And I have to tell myself like, the best thing you can do for yourself is to take a break. And it is tough because we use our hands for so many things. If I do have like sore hands, that just like makes everything harder to do. Like, I can't even do like a lot of emails or like, you know, computer stuff because I got to rest my hands. Or like, I have to like watch myself when I'm cooking because, you know, even the movements that you make cooking can like stress, you know, the muscles that are already sore. So it's a pain in the butt. But it is something that I have to be more aware of.
Yeah, I'm really glad you said that, because that whole sentiment of working through the pain is a real pet peeve of mine, for the obvious reason that I did. And it landed me in hand surgery at the age of 21. So,
oh my gosh.
And I, to be clear, I'm not faulting any of my teachers. What the issue was, and I think still is for a lot of people, and part of the reason I started this podcast, is that I was afraid to talk about how much pain I was in, because I didn't want to fall behind in school.
Yeah.
I wanted to remain competitive. And so I pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed, and I had a torn ligament. I have a pin in my right wrist that will be there for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
And I mean, this is not a technique thing. I have a underlying medical condition that's the reason for all of these problems with my hands. But it's the fact that that space is not there, especially in the piano world, to discuss hand pain and injuries and problems, because you're supposed to just deal with it. That's a huge issue.
Yeah. Like, the technical requirements that we have in music, which are, by the way, like so much higher now than they were, you know, you know, 100 years ago. There's this idea that you kind of have to do what it takes to get there.
Exactly.
And I think there definitely is this enormous stigma that if you can't do it, or if you hurt yourself getting there, you are not cut out for this work. You are weak, you know, you are not worthy. And that idea is so, like, so dangerous, because so many times, like, I've been in this exact situation where I'm facing down, you know, potential pain, and I go, I have worked my entire life for this. I've sacrificed so much. I've like given up other paths. I've given up other things in my life. I can't stop now. I can't accept that I can't do this. So I just got to push through and prove that I deserve to be here. And that, I know I'm not alone in thinking those thoughts. And I feel like we do actively get that messaging so much. Like, I can point to so many times, you know, in my training where I've seen people be praised for performing when they're sick or pushing through some kind of hardship, you know, for the sake of the music. And so I've always just gone like, well, that's what you're supposed to do. So this idea that you got to listen to your body and rest is like, It sounds so obvious to the layperson, but it is an incredibly radical idea to me because of all this, you know, messaging that we get.
Yeah. Well, I think too, I mean, I know one of the things I experienced personally after my second surgery, which was on the same hand, is the first surgery wasn't successful, is basically what it comes down to. And after my second surgery, I had a pin put in my wrist. I was in physical therapy for 8 months. And, you know, I had to start over from scratch when I started playing again. And it was so infuriating when I would get to a point where, you know, you're starting to work on the mistake and I go, ooh, my 20 minutes is up. That's all I'm allowed to do. I got to walk away. And you're like, oh, God. You're just like staring at the piano in disgust, you know? Yeah. It is.
Yeah.
It's so hard to untrain yourself to do some of those bad habit things. Of, I'm just going to do it 100 times until it's right.
Exactly. Like I have done really stupid things recently where I go really hard working on like a specific passage or I work on like, say like only lists and nothing else for some time. And I end up like, you know, finding myself on the verge of injury. And it's so frustrating because like one of the like mindless drilling things that I love doing, like it's so weird, I love doing this, is like taking a passage and drilling it with the metronome from slow to fast, like, you know, one tick at a time.
Yeah.
There's just something very like weirdly zen about it. Like there I get really into the flow.
Yeah.
And it is so frustrating when you are doing that and you're playing this passage hundreds and hundreds of times in a row and it's getting faster and faster. And then you start to feel the pain creep in and you're like, oh, I just want to get to, you know, I want to get from like 60 to 120 or whatever. And like, you have to stop. It's like you said, it's infuriating.
Yeah. Yeah. It is. It's tough to train yourself to do things the right way, especially, I mean, I think things are getting better now, but I think for so long that message of playing through the pain was very much front and center. You know, and you just think, it's like, is there something wrong with me that I can't do this?
Right. And I think we don't get the preparation for that because so much of training takes place when you're young. And I know for me, like hand pain was not remotely an issue for most of my life because kids are like super flexible and can do anything. And like when I was in college, I could just go super, super hard and like play like, you know, Rachmaninoff and Liszt super fast and super hard and heavy, like over and over and over again and be completely fine. Like I could do that without even warming up and be fine.
Right.
And so, you know, by the time that you start to have these issues because, you know, you're older and that's what aging is and science hasn't fixed that for us yet. You've for the most part completed the training that, you know, forms the basis of what you do. And I kind of feel like for me personally, I know maybe not everyone has the experience, but for me, I never really got any type of training on how to, you know, practice or how to listen to your body or what specific types of pain mean. Like I have never been taught that stuff. I had to like look up and teach myself. And I feel like that's a result of classical music being so focused on, you know, on youth.
Mm-hmm. No, you're right about that. I really hadn't thought about that. And it is really hard, to be fair, to talk to students about different types of pain if you haven't experienced it yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and for sure.
You know, once you get to the point where you've had an injury, it's like, oh, now I understand why thing A caused thing B. But it's very abstract otherwise.
Right.
And I don't think I ever really paid attention to, you know, students having certain types of pain until I started having pain myself. It's like, oh, okay, you know, this is what your wrist should not be doing. But like you said, we don't look at that stuff when we're kids. You just go.
Yeah. And I mean, by the time that you get there to the point where you're playing at a high level, you probably, you know, to your point, have picked up a lot of like little habits and ways of doing things that are maybe not good for you, but that are just the way you do things. Like I'm thinking about the fact that, you know, I also used to play violin. And the way I did vibrato was like technically not correct. I would tense up my hand to the point that it kind of shook and like that worked for me.
I
was young, you know, and it totally worked. And then when I started studying with a new teacher in college, she had to like break me entirely down and have me stop vibratoing for some time and then slowly work back up how to vibrato and like, you know, do like the kid thing where you're like doing a very slow wobble with your hand to do it.
Yeah.
Because she could see that the way I was vibratoing, it was unsustainable. Like it was going to injure me at some point. So like that was honestly kind of humiliating because I was like, oh, I'm like, you know, really good at violin, especially, you know, as a pianist, I can, you know, play this other instrument super well. And I can like play these concertos and stuff. And to be told like, you have to go back to like this kid stuff and like relearn how to do things like you're five. It was like really hard for me to do. And of course meant that I couldn't keep going on a lot of the flashy technical stuff that I was doing because I had to, you know, go back to basics.
Yeah.
And I feel like that was hard enough on my secondary instrument. That would just be, you know, really devastating if I had to do that on my primary.
Yeah, I've had to do it. It sucks.
Yeah.
I don't recommend it. Oh. Okay, I'm going to ask, like, the question that everybody hates. I'm sorry, but...
Oh, man.
When you're getting ready for a performance, do you have a set amount of time per day that you practice? I swear I have a reason for asking this.
Okay. Okay. I feel like this answer has definitely changed a lot over the years. Mm-hmm. I was told multiple times at multiple points, that the goal was 5 hours a day.
Yeah.
Like that should be how much I practice. And there was a point in my life where like I was aiming for that. But I really do feel like the older you get, the less sustainable and healthy that is.
Yeah.
So I kind of feel like in my sort of normal daily maintenance practice, you know, that's maybe like 2 or 3 hours.
Okay.
If I am gearing up for a performance, 5 hours is very doable. There have been times that hit like six. Uh-huh. I think in rare cases, seven. That is at the like very top end because I really start to feel there's a point where if I go into like 6 or 7 hours, I'm really just borrowing from my future self.
Yeah.
It means I have to take extra time off, you know, in the following days. So I try not to do that. But for me, I think like 4 to 5 hours is kind of the sweet spot in like getting to that peak performance zone.
Okay. So then my follow-up to that is how do you split it so that you can make it through that amount of time without injuring yourself?
So when I say that, you know, for example, like I say I practiced 4 hours today, that doesn't mean I practiced from like, you know, noon to 4 o'clock.
Right.
It means it took place over a very, very, very large amount of time. Like practicing is a very, very inefficient use of time because in order to have like, say, even 1 hour of practice, I need to set aside like 2 hours. I'm not entirely sure about the math or the formula there, but the way that I personally calculate practice time is I don't go, well, I'm sitting at the piano from 1 to 2, therefore that was an hour for practice. This is so neurotic, I know. I open the stopwatch app on my phone. Mm-hmm. I hit start anytime I start playing, and whenever I stop, I hit stop. So yep. I'm only logging the time I'm actually playing at the piano.
Right.
So even if I like get up to use the bathroom, I get up to like refill my water bottle, like I stop it. That doesn't count as practice time. So like I am purely like logging, like literally the actual physical practice that I'm doing.
Okay.
So that's kind of what I mean by that. I feel like I have to get that out there because for a lot of people, when they say they practice for an hour, that includes like, you know, getting up for water or going to the bathroom or, you know, sitting for a while and thinking about, you know, what to do next. Like if I'm sitting and thinking like that doesn't count to me. So an hour of that distilled practice time takes place over, like I said, maybe 2 hours. And the way I do it is it's both mental and physical. So I'm paying attention to my own mental focus. If I'm in the zone, if I'm in that state of flow, I keep going as long as my hands and my arms can take it. If I'm starting to lag in terms of my like motivation, my focus, I know that means I should take a break and like recharge. And then I'm also paying attention to my physical needs. So if my hands are in that, like, I don't know how to describe it. You feel like you have superpower. You feel like your hands can do anything.
Yeah.
That means for me, keep going. But if I start to feel, you know, like soreness in my deep flexion muscle, or I'm feeling like my pinkies are feeling like they're bruised or something, I know that I need to take a break soon.
Yeah.
And I don't really have set times for my breaks, because it really just comes down to like, how recharged do I feel? So sometimes I'll go like, oh, I'll just, you know, make a cup of tea. And by the time I've drank my tea, I'm feeling fine. Other times I've had my tea, I still don't feel great. So I go off and do something else. I need to read for a little bit and then wait till I feel okay again. So it really, you have to be really adaptive. Because you can't just say like, oh, I know that I just need to take a break for 30 minutes and I'll be fine. It really comes down to how your body and your brain are feeling in that moment that day. So, like I said, you have to set aside a lot of time to get those hours of practice, because there is so much break time and rest that has to be baked into that. So like, I could not practice for like, you know, even 3 hours solid. Like there has to be a break in there.
Okay. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I'm honestly asking because I don't know what it's like to practice that long. I haven't been able to do that in years, but it the funny thing is that sounds totally normal to me, because at my peak when I was in grad school, because I went to grad school after I had a pin put in my wrist, which was maybe not a great idea, but the most I could set in practice was like an hour and a half a day. Like every once in a while I could get to 2 hours, but I was on a very strict 20 minute practice, 10 minute of heating my hands, and I do half of it in the morning and then half of it when I came home from work. So it's the same thing. It's like, look at the clock. When it hits 20 minutes, it doesn't matter what I'm doing. I need to stop.
Yeah.
And so that makes perfect sense to me. I just always thought I was really weird. So I'm kind of glad to hear that you kind of do the stopwatch thing too, because I always felt really neurotic about that.
Yeah, no, I feel whenever I have to explain to people, because I feel like there's this innate like understanding, if you say you practice for 2 hours, people are like, oh, you know, there's like water breaks in there. And I have to be like, no, I do this thing, which I know is completely psychotic, but I use a stopwatch app on my phone. Like when I explain to people, since they're like, okay.
No, I mean, for me, it made sense, because like, if I know, okay, I've only got 20 minutes to sit down, I'm going to be hyper-focused in that 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. How much can I possibly get done? That makes so much more sense to me than just, like you said, sitting down for hours at a time and, like, noodling and hoping it, it does some good.
Right.
So
it's,
I don't think
it has, though, like, it has made me question so many times, though, like, what is practice? Like, it's sort of philosophical. Right. Like, you know, if I'm sitting down and I'm just like, playing a melody with like one hand just to like get it in my ear, like, is that practice or is it not? Should I log it? It's I don't really know if I'll ever come to like a full definition of what is and what isn't practice.
Yeah, I think it depends on the person, but
yeah.
Well, let me ask you my last question here, since we're kind of on this subject. It's a good place to close. All of this conversation being taken into account, do you think the expectations of classical musicians are too high?
I think there are, yes, there's so many expectations that sometimes are like sort of self-defeating. I think for sure, I mentioned earlier that the technical expectations and requirements that we have for pianists is so much higher at this point in history than it has ever been. And I don't know if that's necessarily super healthy, because this idea that, you know, you have to churn out these, you know, like list etudes and hit all these like metrics in order to prove that you're worthy of playing expressive music, like, I don't know if that's really helpful. Because I feel like it rewards a very narrow certain type of musician, and also, like we've just been talking about, like, leads to injury. So I think in terms of the sort of technical musical requirements, that's an issue. I think that the types of repertoire requirements that we have in, you know, classical training and conservatory don't really allow for exploration. This idea that you are only allowed to explore music outside of the usual repertoire requirements until you are like well into a musical career, like, that's a weird idea to me. Like,
it is weird.
For me, I only recently started learning, you know, music by women, and by women, I mean you know, white European women in the 19th century. Like it's still very narrow. Like I only started doing that recently because I had more freedom. And I'm like, I feel like I would have benefited a lot from starting this work back in conservatory. Right. I think also the expectation of like behavior and how you're supposed to present the music. I know that I've written about the sort of impossible expectations for women presenting themselves on stage, how we're supposed to dress. Like an impossible needle to thread. This idea that you're supposed to make yourself like, you know, attractive, but not in a way that shows that you are obviously attractive. Like it's just insane. And also I think we touched on this with the humor aspect, like how you're supposed to present the music and also how you're supposed to conduct yourself. Like, you know, you said that you found me on Twitter where I'm, you know, oftentimes like very, very real, very, you said sarcastic. I don't know if that's how I describe myself, but you know, I'm away on Twitter. And sometimes I get people pushing back and like, this is not how you should behave as a full class musician. I'm like, who are you to, like, this is who I am. And the music reflects who I am. Like who are you to say that I can't be this, you know, part of myself? So I feel like there definitely are these sort of archetypes that musicians are expected to hew to. And that just is very odd to me because it's such a personal, vulnerable thing to perform music, where you have to be so true to who you are that the idea that you're supposed to not be true to yourself in order to sell the music that you are expressing, like that's just a weird self-defeating idea to me.
All of that is, those are all really good points. And I think what I have in the back of my head when I ask that question is the expectation that classical musicians at their peak be outstanding performers, outstanding teachers, you know, have done God knows how much research, because I feel like that doesn't allow time for you to actually become a human being and have something to contribute to the music. You know, if you are spending all of your time making sure that you are the best pianist or cellist or whatever it is, I don't necessarily want to hear you play because all you've done is sit in a practice room. And that I feel has gotten really dated, and I think it's dangerous. I think it's very dangerous to expect people to do that much stuff, because how much do you have to sacrifice of yourself to accomplish that? Does that make sense?
Right. Like I've said this before, I think in other interviews, but I really fully believe that you have to, in order to be a good musician, you have to be a whole person outside of music.
Yeah.
Like if someone were to, you know, strictly excise the music from your life, like you should still have a rich, full life.
Yeah.
And I fully believe that, because I kind of feel like having known people who sort of sacrifice everything to music and have no real personality or life outside of it, like there's something missing in their music. I feel like it, you know, it goes back to that. Like you can tell when people aren't full, whole people. And that's just, I feel like just on a spiritual level, like really bad. And so I feel like this emphasis on perfection or on transcendence that you as a musician are supposed to be kind of like non-human almost. It's just a very detrimental idea to music, because it is ultimately, you know, something created by human beings for human beings. And it's a way of expressing our humanity. And that is something that we have to remember, that it is stuff by and for human beings. And that there are, you know, quirks and imperfections in there.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and you know, at the end of the day, what we're still doing as quote unquote classical musicians is, you know, prolonging this concept that was, you know, active in the 18th century, which is when musicians were indentured serfs, you know, servants.
It's like, yeah.
No, they didn't necessarily want to do that stuff for 12 hours a day. They didn't have a choice. Like, should we still have the same expectations? That really doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I don't know.
I mean, this is all stuff that I feel like you could do like a whole other podcast just on this subject.
Right.
Yeah.
It's a little crazy. I do hope, though, I really do hope that starts to change, because I think it's really important that we encourage young kids who are interested in classical music to pursue that and not feel like they have to, like you said, give up some aspect of their personality to be good at it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What is that?
Exactly.
Anyway. All right. Well, I think we solved all the world's problems. What about you?
I think so. I think we've got a, you know, great guideline. I think everyone should just do things and the world will be fixed. Good job, us.
Oh, well, I would like to thank you for being my guest today for Welcome to My Nerd Brain. It's really been great talking to you. I've had a lot of fun chatting. I appreciate you making the time.
I appreciate you inviting me on here. This is really fun.
Awesome. I'm going to do our social media shout outs and I'll give you a chance to shout out anything else at the end here. So let's see. You can find me online at welcometomynerdbrain.com or on Instagram at welcometomynerdbrain. I'm also on Twitter at welcomenerd, which is my favorite Twitter handle ever. Lastly, I do have an online community of both past guests and listeners that you can find on Facebook groups, and that's called the Nerd Brainiacs. And that's exclusive content that you won't find on any of the other social media platforms. You can find Sharon Sue online at sharonsue.com. That's sharonsu.com. On Twitter at Doodly Roses, which is fun to say. And that's Doodly with no E. D-O-O-D-L-Y. I had a hard time spelling that. I was like, what's the correct form of Doodly?
I know. I don't think it's a real word. I made it up.
There you go. Her Facebook page is Sharon Sue Piano, and her Instagram handle is also Doodly Roses. Did I miss anything? Is there anything else you'd like to promote?
Yeah, I secretly have a Patreon. It's not awesome. Secret. It really comes up. But I do post a weekly newsletter where I talk about a lot of stuff that is not even remotely related to music. Again, going back to the idea that you should be a whole person outside of music. I also talk about, like, you know, ongoing projects and, you know, have little updates only for the patron supporters of stuff I'm working on. So if you like me as a person, I guess, consider supporting me on Patreon. I also post practice videos and stuff, so you can actually see me practice, and there's a lot of imperfection there.
Yeah, that's really brave. Good for you. What's the URL for that?
Oh, that's Patreon? That's a great question. I think it's patreon.com/SharonSue.
Okay. All right. So as always, stay well, stay healthy, and wash your damn hands.
That's right.
If you have ever considered trying CBD or just want to learn more about it, you're in luck because I happen to be a sales rep for CBD BioCare. CBD BioCare is a small business based in Florida that prides itself on producing high-quality CBD products made right here in the U.S. in FDA-approved facilities. We offer a really fantastic skincare line as well as wellness products, pain treatment products, and even a full line for pets. Visit my personal CBD BioCare page at cbdbiocare.com/pages/efranson, that's E-F-R-A-N-S-E-N, and enter the code EFRANSON at checkout to receive an additional 5% off your purchase. Again, that's cbdbiocare.com/pages/efranson.